From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take 2, me Martinez. Governor Gavin Newsom says pro sports can start back up in California in the first week of June, with other parts of the state starting to open up on a wider scale. We'll ask our expert if it's too much too fast. Plus, comedian Tom Papa's Netflix special is called You're Doing Great. His new book is titled You're Doing Great and Other Reasons to Stay Alive. Find out what they are all ahead on Take 2. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take 2. I'm E. Martinez. Thanks for being with us today. We are now entering the ninth week of quarantine, but things are easing up even more quickly than we had thought it would. Just over an hour ago, Governor Gavin Newsom said pro sports could resume in California in the first week of June. That's just 2 weeks from today. We're going to talk to a medical expert about what we should and should not be doing as we all emerge from these stay-at-home orders. Plus, we'll get the skinny on testing and why it takes so long for some to get results. But first, the effects all of this is having on public education. Governor Newsom announced massive cuts to K-12 education in the state, and today we heard a little bit about how that might affect the Los Angeles Unified School District. Superintendent Austin Buettner weighed in this morning and talked about how to keep kids engaged in learning. KPCC's education reporter Kyle Stokes is here again. Hello, Kyle.
Hi, A.
All right. Superintendent Buettner lamented the effect this pandemic is having on kids and the fact that there seems to be little extra support for them and their education on a state level. What did he have to say?
Well, yeah, I think there's a broad concern across the state among educators. Governor Gavin Newsom has even mentioned the concern that students, while there's a lot of efforts to try and make sure that they do learn while they're having to learn from home, while campuses are closed. Despite all of these efforts, there's a lot of concern that students are just falling behind. And I think what we heard today from Superintendent Austin Buettner was concern that coming cuts in the state budget, cuts to state education funding, could make all of this even worse. Here's what he had to say. Well, it sounds like we don't have that tape.
Yeah, we don't have that
us.
One, yeah.
Sorry about that. I thought that we would have that tape. So essentially what he said was that cuts to the school system are going to be, you know, increase that problem of learning loss for students. And, you know, on top of that, he said that those cuts could be just as harmful as the coronavirus itself if they were to take effect. And I think there are a lot of ways that it could be harmful, not only on the factor of learning loss, but the potential that students could be put into unsafe situations. I mean, there are people who have talked about educators, education advocacy groups that have talked about how it could be unsafe to open schools in an age yeah. where budget cuts are a reality.
Briefly remind us what cuts public education is facing.
Yeah, it's a lot. I mean, the governor's budget essentially outlines the potential for a $6.5 billion cut to the state's main K-12 education funding formula, and overall basically about a 10% cut during the Great Recession. We saw something like a 13% cut, so we're sort of into that Great Recession territory if those cuts were to take effect. Now, the governor has said that if the federal government comes through with a stimulus package, new aid for state and local governments, he would roll back those cuts of $6.5 billion. So there is, you know, some hope there. It's not a foregone conclusion that schools are going to see these kinds of cuts. But if they do take effect, those are the kinds of cuts of the magnitude that would necessitate some pretty deep cost-cutting measures, including potentially, although this might be too early to say too, layoffs and program cuts, a lot of things that could have a really deleterious effect on students' learning.
Now, it still remains to be seen, Kyle, whether LAUSD classes can resume in the fall in person as normal. So this gets to how students have been learning and will continue to learn. So what do we know about this right now and what's been achieved? And actually then what's still missing?
Yeah, so we actually got an interesting look at some survey data from the district. LAUSD has been tracking whether students are connected to the district, connected to the online systems where most of their learning is taking place. And that's where most of the learning has been taking place. But I think that what we see here, and we, you know, last week the district came out with a statement saying that just about every student now has a laptop. And at the time, I sort of wrote a story that laid out, well, they're saying now every student has a laptop, but on the other hand, here's all of this anecdotal evidence that a lot of people still are disconnected. This parent survey that was recently outlined from a bunch of families in East LA of about 12,000. LAUSD families in East LA says that despite efforts to distribute these laptops by LAUSD to all of these families, that a lot of kids still don't have laptops. About 27% still don't have laptops. That number has certainly decreased since the district has continued to distribute the laptops through its program, but still some technology gaps remaining, and technology being the biggest challenge that students face as they're trying to learn.
That's KPCC education reporter Kyle Stokes. Kyle, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Out of the streets, we've now had 2 weekends in a row where Angelenos could more or less feel free to walk most streets, also the paths and beaches throughout the county as well. And this past weekend, a couple of LA neighborhoods went a step further, closed off local streets to through traffic. It's so residents could easily walk near their homes while maintaining physical distance from others by walking on the roads, too. It's part of a new city program called Slow Streets, and it was first pitched by L.A. City Councilman Mike Bonin. He represents much of the city's west side. He's here now to tell us some more about it. Welcome.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
Now, the first set of Slow Streets happened on a collection of roads in your district in the Delray and West L.A. neighborhoods. How did it go this weekend?
It went really well. I mean, the feedback we've been getting from families has been amazing. You know, I'm just looking through some screenshots I took this morning on social media. I don't know about you, but it's a joy to see all the kids in the street playing, all the people walking up and down without concerns about cars, motorbikes, or traffic. I love this. Just tons of comments like that.
Now, okay, on a basic level, how does this work for residents? And who should or shouldn't be taking advantage of Slow Streets?
Right now, I mean, it started with two neighborhoods in my district. They're given cones and signs that they put at the end of the street, say Slow Streets, and it's basically restricted to local neighborhood traffic only. It has had a very good effect of slowing traffic down and giving people a little more space, a little more elbow room to get out and about.
Now, these kinds of slow street programs have been around in other cities, New York, San Francisco, for weeks. You were the first to pitch it as an idea for L.A. Why?
I'll tell you, you know, I'm a parent of a young kid, and I hear from other parents of young kids, and folks were going stir crazy. I mean, they couldn't take their kids to the playground. The kids need a place to go. They're cooped up in the apartment. I was also hearing from seniors who need to go take a walk, and people were getting concerned that when they went out, if they walked down the sidewalk, they couldn't adhere to social distancing without somebody going into the road. With fewer cars on the road, people were driving faster. So people didn't feel safe, and collisions were up. Hmm. So this just seemed like a smart thing to do. We had the space to use. Let the people who need it use it.
Councilman, I know at first Mayor Eric Garcetti and County Health Director Barbara Ferrer were skeptical. What changed for them? What got them on board?
Well, I think the mayor was always with us intuitively. I think Dr. Ferrer needed a little bit more convincing. I think that there was a misconception about what the program was. I think some people imagined this was going to be Ciclovia, a big regional draw who were coming from all over the place. This is about letting people use their own neighborhood streets for neighborhood and family-friendly purposes. And I think we demonstrated over the first weekend that's pretty much exactly what it was. And I think it will bode well for other neighborhoods that want to do the same.
We're talking to Los Angeles City Councilman Mike Bonin about his program called Slow Streets. And last week, the mayor announced that people in other neighborhoods can also apply to have local streets around them closed off through traffic. How's the application process going to work?
You go to LADOT and you do a thing online. About 14 different neighborhoods, that's as of earlier, had already signed up and said they want to be a part of it. And I think we're going to be getting a lot more. You can just go to ladot.lacity.org, and there's an application there.
You know, traffic noticeably reduced when stay-at-home orders went into effect. But LAPD announced last week that traffic fatalities are still happening at the same rate compared to a year ago. Councilman, what does that tell you about the safety of LA streets in spite of the different measures you might take?
The safety of LA streets is not nearly good enough for pedestrians, for cyclists, for seniors, for anybody, really. I mean, it has been a chronic and significant public health issue for years. And one of the things that I think this pandemic and the circumstances demonstrates is that one of the biggest factors in fatalities and in serious collisions, injuries, is the speed with which cars are going. The faster a car that is going when it hits you, the more damage it's going to do. And the wider the space is, psychologically, the faster someone drives. It just feels natural to them. So with fewer cars on the road, people have just gone faster. And we need to be doing a lot more aggressive stuff to make sure that everybody is safe using our roads.
How long do you think this program will keep going?
Well, I hope it'll keep going at least through the pandemic. There's a desperate and a crying need for it. It's going to be a while before playgrounds come back on. Talking to the head of our Recreation and Parks Department, and in order to keep the playgrounds clean, there's going to have to be significantly more staffing to sanitize and all that. So there's going to be a need for kids, there's going to be a need for seniors, and there's going to be a need for folks for a while to come. Whether or not this is something that lasts past the pandemic, that really depends on what people think of it and how attached they become to it.
Now, I also wanted to talk with you about the bike paths along the beach, which are still closed. On LAS.com, our own staff wrote Saturday about how they couldn't get a public health official to explain why. Today, a spokesperson from the County Department of Beaches and Harbors called us to clarify that the bike paths are closed off to everyone, bikes and pedestrians included, to reduce crowding in general. But you've called on the public health department to reopen the bike paths as well as the beach parking lots. So why?
Yeah, I have. The beach parking lots and the parking lots near some of the trails, hiking trails as well. Well, my perspective is we're letting people surf at the beach. We're letting people swim at the beach. We're letting people walk at the beach. I don't know why we're not letting people ride their bikes to the beach. You can ride your bike on the bike paths on all of the other parts of Los Angeles. And why you can't do it there is a little confusing to me. It's also, if you look at the bike path, the coastal bike path with stretches from Torrance to the Palisades, it's wider than most of the hiking trails that we're allowing people to use. It's easier to socially distance there. And frankly, it is also a commuter path for a lot of people trying to get to and from jobs on the coastal side of town.
Now, when it comes to the bike paths, so wondering if they're open or closed, as much as officials say they're working together on the issue of coronavirus, that's a clear example of a disconnect sometimes. Now, what's your message to Angelenos who see this play out and then have trouble trusting who to best believe?
Ultimately, the call is going to be made by the public health officials. And when the public health officials make what we feel is a wrong decision based on what we feel is incorrect info, we should share that with them and try to get a better viewpoint and perspective from them. I got to say, part of Dr. Ferrer's concern, I understand, is that she just feels the bike path is a big crowd draw. I don't see the bike path as being more of a crowd draw than the water. I think the water is really the draw, not so much the bike path. But to the extent that people who are out there now using our beaches, using our trails, are failing to or refusing to practice physical distancing and wear their masks and are hanging out and violating the rules, the slower we will be to get to any other resources and access. So people need to hold up their end of the bargain so that Dr. Ferrer and the public health officials will start opening more up.
That's Mike Bonin, LA City Councilman, representing much of the West Side, including Venice and Brentwood. Councilman, thanks a lot.
You bet. Thanks.
All right, you may have been seeing people laying out on the beach this weekend, doing exactly what LA County says is not allowed, and are wondering if that will eventually come back to bite us. Or maybe you've been thinking about getting a coronavirus test and hearing that results don't come back for over a week or so. Well, it's okay to have questions because we've got experts with answers. That's coming up next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm Amy Martinez. Another weekend is behind us, and you could see that people felt a little bit more free to move about. People hanging at the beach, walking the trails, shopping even. Yeah, today, LA County reported 477 new cases, bringing the total to 38,451. And testing capabilities still seem sporadic. So are we all going about this in the right way? Well, let's put all of this into context and answer some of your questions. And to do that, we have Paula Cannon on the line. She's a professor of molecular microbiology and immunology at USC's Keck School of Medicine. Welcome back.
Hi, good to be back.
Good to have you back. All right. It was a warm weekend, despite today being so rainy. It was a warm weekend. Seems like a lot of people were out enjoying the outdoors. What's your sense of how this reopening is going so far?
Well, actually, I was kind of pleasantly surprised, at least based on the photographs I saw of the beaches. People were, you know, separated. They were walking. People were wearing masks. I was actually kind of quite surprised. And I think, you know, perhaps we've heard the message from Governor Newsom, and we know that if we exhibit bad behavior, you know, he's going to be like a daddy and say that, you know, take our toy away and say that the beach is going to be closed again. So I think people in general are sort of, you know, behaving appropriately.
And what are your main concerns at this point? And how can we all maybe do better, in your opinion? If there's any little areas, if you wanted to nitpick, you can right now.
Sure. Well, of course, the biggest area is about wearing masks and recognizing that even if you feel fine, you could be infected. And even if you're outdoors, you could infect someone else. So that's why we ask people to wear a mask. And honestly, I know it's a pain. I have multiple masks. I haven't yet found one I love. And I know everybody would prefer not to, but it's such a small sacrifice, yeah. A huge privilege of being outdoors in a space where other people are going to be. And honestly, if you find that too hard, then please enjoy your balcony or enjoy your backyard and, you know, mask-free. But if you're going to be at the beach or outdoors, please do this one thing.
Now, on the topic of reopening on a larger scale, Governor Gavin Newsom has said today that professional sports, could start back up in California in the first week of June. No fans in the stands, with modifications, very prescriptive conditions. Professor, what do you think first of that announcement? Because that's just 2 weeks from now. That's only 2 weeks from now. And what conditions would you suggest?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the biggest thing for me is to think about the safety of the players and their coaches and everybody else in the organization, because basically that now becomes one large family that is sort of quarantining together, but is, you know, also putting each other at risk. So I think a really important thing would be to have very frequent testing available for everybody in that organization. And then just for the players to recognize, obviously, they can't be socially distant when they're playing, and they're going to be handling things like footballs, for example, and passing them on. So, you know, it's just really impossible for them to be socially distant unless, you know, I guess unless they're playing golf, which, you know, yeah. Tailor-made for the pandemic. Maybe we'll all start watching golf games instead.
You know what terrifies me, Professor, on this is number one, the spontaneity of sports. If someone hits a game-winning shot, what do? You run and hug them, and then everyone's gathered together, jumping up and screaming. That terrifies me, first off. And then coaches. A lot of the coaches are people in their 60s or even 70s. I hope that all that is thought of well in advance. It kind of worries me a little bit that it's only 2 weeks away. So I'm hoping that those plans are at least in the works.
I'm sure they are. I think every organization is making plans in different ways. And again, there are things that can be done. So I hope they have testing capabilities in place. And that, as you say, the older people, the people who are more vulnerable, recognize their vulnerability, and that everybody else in the team and in the organization gathers around to kind of basically protect them by having, you know, these different types of behaviors.
Now, on the note of going out, we have this question from Mike Kim. Quote, Mayor Garcetti announced that starting today, people would have to wear face masks when outside their home, but there's a lot of nuance missing. Does that include me driving around in my car with the windows rolled up and the AC on? What if you're just walking along a deserted street? So what do you think, Professor?
Okay, so sure. So nuance is also another word for common sense. So, no, if you're in your car and you're the only person and the windows are wound up, you don't need to wear a mask. That kind of makes no sense. But if you're walking in a deserted street, I would kind of question whether or not it's really a deserted street, especially in Los Angeles. You know, people can come out of driveways, come around corners. So I think unless you truly are, I don't know, in Dodger's parking lot at 4 a.m. and you know nobody else is there, you should probably, you know, wear a mask, just recognizing that it's probably not as deserted as you think.
Now, another question. How does the openings apply to people 65 and older? Can they go out as allowed?
Oh, that's a tricky one because, you know, now that comes down to sort of individual risk and your individual risk assessment. So if you can do it safely and you wear a mask and you feel safe, then yes. It's kind of personal for me this age because my husband is 65 and I know he hates to think of himself as a senior. But frankly, this coronavirus doesn't care. So we will walk together in our neighborhood, but we take the less traveled and, frankly, less scenic streets. And I'm the designated shopper, and I'm the person who brings the parcels in from outside. And he had a hard time letting me do this at first. It's kind of tough being married to a virologist during the pandemic. But I think now he understands how serious this is, especially given that he's 65.
I didn't mean to laugh, Professor, but it's kind of funny. It's kind of funny. You're married to a virologist, and he doesn't want you to go outside and bring this stuff back. I guess no matter the education, sometimes we just kind of go back to just being people, human beings.
Indeed.
We're talking to Paula Cannon. She's a professor of molecular microbiology and immunology at USC's Keck School of Medicine. Now, one big issue with opening back up is testing. Now, while everyone in LA can go get tested, regardless of symptoms or exposure, there's still a lot of questions about how it all works. So first question on this, Professor, how many types of tests are there and what determines which ones we use?
Okay, so there's two main types. The first one, which we call a PCR test, is actually a test for the virus. So to do that, you get swabbed in your nose or your throat because that's where the virus lives. The second test, which is a little more indirect, is what we call an antibody test, and that's a test that's done on blood. And it's looking instead for the body's response to the virus and specifically for the presence of antibodies. So this type of test is not as precise because it can reflect both the fact that you are towards the end of a current infection or that you've been previously infected. Whereas the PCR virus test is much more accurate and specific.
Now, on the coronavirus test itself, do we know what tests are being used most frequently in LA County? I've heard that there are different kinds of tests used in different parts of the country.
Sure. And really, most people are using PCR-based tests. Okay. And they're just using different kits, different equipment, different companies. So that's the kind of the confusion. And quite frankly, it's often to do with, you know, if you're a hospital, which machine do you have in your labs that you can use for this? Where can you get some of the kits that you need and the reagents? So that's the reason for all this variety.
Now, I know the Federal Drug Administration has warned about the accuracy of the Abbott coronavirus tests. Professor, what do you know about this and whether it's being used here in LA?
Sure, and this is a famous test that's being used in the White House as well. So in fairness to Abbott, you know, they brought out this test because it uses a machine that a lot of hospitals and healthcare centers have that does a very rapid test. Ordinarily, it's testing for other respiratory viruses like influenza, for example, and the company have adapted it to also test for the coronavirus. And everything was going okay until a research group said, whoa, wait a minute, in our hands, this test is missing a lot of positives. Abbott has kind of pushed back a bit and said that's because we're not using it as it's intended. It's a test whereby people walk into a doctor's office, they get swabbed, the swab gets put instantly into the machine, and you get your result in 5 minutes. And my understanding is that these tests that have been reported were done whereby people took the sample and, you know, put it in saline or force shipped it. So it wasn't being used exactly as the manufacturers recommended. So I think we're going to hear more, you know, in the next few days or weeks about whether or not Abbott needs to make any adjustments. But having these what we call point of care tests where you can, you know, get a result in 5 minutes is going to be a super important thing for protecting, you know, not just our president, but our sports teams and people working in, you know, in hospitals and healthcare centers.
Professor, before we go on, if you could just move the receiver a little closer to your mouth. This is our new reality in radio broadcasting. Our connections aren't always perfect. But so here's another one. So we're hearing from several sources who have been tested that the results don't come back for maybe more than a week or more. And members of the same family get results at different times. What insights do you have as to why there is a delay in some cases?
Sure. So that has a lot to do with the fact that the place where you get sampled or swabbed won't always be the place that does the test. So tests have to be shipped, sent overnight to a lab, And then depending on how crazy busy that lab is, you know, samples may have to wait, and then the results have to be checked, and it all has to be kind of, you know, typed into something and sent to you. So there's a lot of just logistical steps that are involved in the process. I think, you know, things are getting better and faster. You know, more and more kits are available, more labs are able to do this. People are just, you know, they've ironed out some of the glitches. So I think now and going forward, you know, the speed with which you get a result back is going to be faster and faster. I think it's typically about 3 days at the moment in LA County.
Now, so that gives us to this question from a listener. Are there any restrictions to how many times you can take the free COVID-19 test in LA County? Now that they've expanded testing to asymptomatic people, can someone take it, say, every 2 weeks if they wish?
Oh, Lordy, the worried well. Okay. So the rules, as I understand them currently, are that the county will support testing as a priority of anybody with symptoms. And then anybody who's in like an institutionalized setting, like a, you know, a skilled nursing facility and or essential workers. And then they're expanding it. You know, the next tier of people are, you know, people over 65 or people with underlying health conditions. So the idea that if you have none of those criteria and you're asymptomatic and you just want to test because you're, you know, worried about this, if there is capacity, you can get tested. But I think I would say to people, you know, if you've been isolating in your home for a month and you've not been near anybody, you know, you're not going to have the coronavirus. So maybe just think twice about taking up that slot, and let's leave it for the people who really are at risk at present.
Okay, so now something from today that's got a lot of people hopeful, vaccines, and we're hearing a lot about promising results of an early vaccine trial. So who's conducting these trials, and why is there optimism today?
Yeah, no, this is kind of exciting. So the company that reported data today is called Moderna, and they were the first into the clinic. I think in the middle of March, they started doing a trial in Seattle. And they've reported today the results from 8 people who got a couple of doses of their vaccine. And the good news is that those people have made antibodies, and they look to be the same type of antibodies and at the same level that people make when they have a normal infection. And, you know, the reason that Moderna were able to go so quickly is because their vaccine is what's called an RNA vaccine. It's much easier to make. You chemically synthesize it, so it's a bit more like a drug. You inject it into people, and the RNA contains the blueprint to make a piece of the virus. It's the blobby spike on the outside of the virus, and hopefully that fools your body into thinking you've been attacked by the virus, and the body then responds and makes antibodies. So I think it's exciting, but it's only 8 people.
Okay.
You know, they're scaling up. They're doing more people, and there's other companies also using a similar technology of these RNA vaccines. But, you know what, it's nice to get some good news once in a while, and this is definitely, this is good news.
A sliver of hope, that's all I think anybody wants. Paula Cannon is a professor of molecular microbiology and immunology at USC's Keck School of Medicine. Paula, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Ed. Bye.
All right, switching gears. This past Saturday night, a series of explosions rocked downtown LA, preceded by a building fire. It happened on a block known for vaping supplies. First responders were able to get to the blaze and under control in about 90 minutes, but the fire left a dozen firefighters injured. And today, the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives announced it will assist in the investigation behind what caused the disaster. KPCC and LAS digital editor Brian Frank has been covering the story. He's here to give us some more details. Brian, welcome.
Hey, thanks.
Now, what's known right now about how the fire potentially started?
I mean, that's really the heart of the investigation right now. What happened initially was there was a response to a call at 327 East Boyd Street, downtown near the intersection with San Pedro. This was like 6:30 p.m. Saturday night. They got a call of a fire at a warehouse there. And when the firefighters went into the building, there was an explosion. And that's really going to complicate how they identify what happened.
Now, we mentioned 12 firefighters were injured. Here's LAFD Chief Ralph Terrazas talking to one of our reporters over the weekend.
A lot of our firefighters were traumatized. I spoke to them directly, and they're holding up. But when one of your own is injured, You can imagine the amount of emotional stress.
Brian, what happened and how are these firefighters doing now?
Well, as of this morning, there was an update from the fire department, and Chief Terrazas gave another statement saying that there's six firefighters left in the hospital. And of all of those six, they're all in stable condition now. That said, there were two who were initially in critical condition. So even though their condition has improved, there's one of them with really severe burns and a few others with moderate burns. So these are not light injuries, and it's going to take a lot of time for some of these guys to recover. Captain Eric Scott, he's the spokesman for the department. He actually called this one of the most significant incidents that the department has had to face in recent memory. And you know, there's actually video, a couple of different videos going around that show this, and it's a really harrowing scene. You know, there's an aerial ladder propped up against the side of the building, and you can see these firefighters coming down across the ladder, and they have to go single file. And yet there's this wall of flames behind them, to the side of them, around them, and it just slowly, and it almost looks like it engulfs them. And so the fact that any of them got out is very lucky. Anecdotally, my brother is actually LA City Fire. He wasn't working at the time. But he's been on the department for 19 years. He agrees with this assessment, that this is a pretty significant one. You know, there may be one, you know, incidents where there's one firefighter injured, maybe even a firefighter killed, but to have 11 of them hospitalized is a pretty pretty serious thing.
One more thing, Brian. The business involved in this is called Smoke Tokes. What do we know about Smoke Tokes?
Not a whole lot yet. You know, what we do, as you pointed out, it's a vaping supply company. Their website lists e-cigarettes, vape pens, hookahs, water pipes, but also things like butane cases and lighters and torches. We know that this business was associated with another fire downtown just nearby, you know, maybe a couple of buildings over, back in September 2016. And that fire took about 160 firefighters more than 2 hours to extinguish. I put in a call to a number that we think is associated, well, it is associated with Smoke Tokes, but I couldn't get through, so left a message. We're hoping to get in contact and learn more and speak directly to the business.
And one more thing, Brian, LAFD and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives announced they're going to work together on an investigation. What will they be trying to uncover?
I mean, the first job is to just really identify the source. I mean, we've heard that, you know, there were these butane canisters that blew up and went as far as two blocks away, or at least two blocks away, and caused the fire to continue to spread. But they still want to be sure about the source of the ignition. I did speak with an ATF spokesperson, but they're not really ready to talk about this yet. They have investigators arriving on scene today, so they say they can maybe give us more details tomorrow. But what we can say is this is a team that includes arson and explosive experts. They even use canine units to assist with the investigation. And they also help local agencies put together evidence for possible criminal investigations.
All right, we'll be monitoring this story today on All Things Considered. Brian Frank, digital editor for KPCC and LAS. Brian, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, we've heard a lot about pandemic-related things happening in LA County. Next, we're going to head to our neighbors in the south, Orange County. Some of the coronavirus news there centers around lawsuits and court cases. We'll hear what happened in the case of Huntington Beach versus Governor Gavin Newsom. That's next when Take Two continues.
Stars shining bright above you. Night breezes seem to whisper, I love you. Birds singing in the sycamore tree. Dream a little dream of me.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on kpcc.org. I'm E. Martinez. When Governor Gavin Newsom closed the state's beaches in an effort to slow the spread of COVID-19, the city of Huntington Beach sued. On Friday, that case was rejected by a judge in the Superior Court. It's just many of the virus-related happenings in Orange County. Let's get the latest on that ruling and a couple of more need-to-know stories from Nick Gerda. He's a reporter for the nonprofit news site Voice of OC, joins us every single Monday. Hey, Nick.
Hey, great to be here.
And okay, so as I understand it, the ruling was based on a few things. One was changing times, the other legal precedent. What did the judge have to say?
Yeah, exactly. It was based on changing times in the last week or two, and then also legal precedent going back over 100 years. The judge, Nathan R. Scott of Orange County Superior Court, noted that the beaches are now open for active use, so that circumstances changed from when those lawsuits were first filed. At the outset, the governor had said he wanted to get plans from the cities to reopen them, and he did approve those plans. So the beaches are open for walking, running, and even people have been able to sunbathe without getting enforcement by the police. But also the judge pointed to Supreme Court precedent talking about the broader issue of balancing civil rights with how to prevent a pandemic and the public health threat of that. And he basically pointed to this U.S. Supreme Court decision from back in 1905 called Jacobson v. Massachusetts, which is getting cited by a lot of judges these days. And that decision came during the smallpox epidemic and upheld a state's right to have mandatory vaccination laws and to fine people who violate them. And one of the key quotes that judges are citing from that decision is, quote, "A community has the right to protect itself against an epidemic of disease which threatens the safety of its members." So that's getting cited a lot in Orange County in these recent rulings, that essentially these public health orders can stand as long as they are tied to protecting public health and not basically invading on clear rights secured by fundamental law. So that's where it's standing right now.
Pretty amazing, though, that rights during an outbreak were an issue going back to 1905. I mean, that's a long time.
It is.
Yeah. Has there been any response from Huntington Beach on this?
Yeah. So their city attorney issued a statement, and coincidentally, he's the only elected city attorney in Orange County out of all 34 cities. And that city attorney, Michael Gates, said he was disappointed in the ruling, but that it suggests the city's lawsuit succeeded in sort of pressuring the governor to step back from the full beach closures. It's worth noting there was a separate federal ruling in a case brought by a Newport Beach councilman, which found that even if the full beach closures were in effect, the state's right to prevent the spread of coronavirus would likely outweigh the people's right, individual right, to go to the beach. So there's a lot of new legal rulings coming in from the courts, weighing in on sort of this balance between individual rights and the right to protect against a disease spreading.
So, Nick, what is the beach situation in Orange County? What's open, what's not, and are people using them in a safe way?
Yeah, so overall, I mean, every single city and county entity that has control over beaches in Orange County has gotten approval to reopen. And it's been pretty lax enforcement in the sense of there are police officers going around reminding people about social distancing. But we've been hearing about, you know, one park ranger for 4 miles of coastline or 7 miles of coastline. So there's not a whole lot of, crackdowns or things like that going on. But there are reminders to people from the cities and from the county to please maintain social distancing with people outside your household to avoid spreading coronavirus.
We're talking to Nick Gerda from The Voice of OC. All right, let's catch up on some other important stories from Orange County that may have slipped under the radar a bit, starting with Irvine. And just days after approving antibody tests for coronavirus, the city council could have a vote to revoke that decision. Why is that a possibility now?
Yeah, so this is something we reported on last week and brought to light. The city of Irvine had been moving forward towards a contract to, and actually gave approval to do a contract to do wide-scale antibody testing for individual results. And the issue that was raised by the county health officials and the medical director for Orange County at Kaiser, who we spoke to, was that this kind of individual level results for antibody testing is problematic at this stage for two reasons. One is there's a high rate of false positives positives for the test. So it could show that someone has antibodies when they actually don't. And that's just the nature of the early stage of the development of these tests. And then the second part is that we still don't understand fully how immunity works with coronavirus. And so we don't know how many antibodies someone needs to have immunity, and we don't know how long that immunity lasts. It's still being researched, according to these medical experts. So we ran a story on kind of the cautioning that's been going on from the medical community about this kind of individual results from antibodies. And as soon as the story came out, the mayor of Irvine saw it, asked the city manager to confirm it. Is it true that these tests are not actually FDA approved? City manager said yes, according to the mayor. And the mayor said she, based on following up on her story, would be rescinding her support for that contract and calling for a revote to pull it back. A
couple more things. Orange County supervisors are going to debate two different bailout proposals for local businesses this week. The money would come from the CARES Act passed in March. Orange County got about $500 million under that. What proposals are on the table right now?
Yeah, so there's two competing proposals that are up for a vote tomorrow by the Orange County Board of Supervisors. The first was proposed last Tuesday by Supervisors Don Wagner and Michelle Steele. They proposed basically $75 million that would be distributed to cities to hand out to or to provide to small businesses in their communities to help them through this difficult time economically. And then a couple days later, there was a counterproposal from two other supervisors, Lisa Bartlett and Andrew Doe, that proposed $110 million. So they kind of upped the ante and they expanded the categories to nonprofit groups, food banks, as well as small businesses. Those are both coming to a head at the board meeting tomorrow. And it looks like the swing vote is Doug Chafee, the one Democrat on the five-member board. And we'll see which way that goes.
All right. That's Nick Gerter, reporter for The Voice of OC. Nick, as always, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, the last time we spoke to comedian Tom Papa was about his Netflix special, You're Doing Great. It's all about how despite all the craziness in the world and the stress it all causes, that things are really better than you might think. Well, now there's more because that Netflix special has been turned into a book and it's called You're Doing Great and Other Reasons to Stay Alive. Tom Papa will reveal those reasons when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. On March 19th, Governor Gavin Newsom ordered all Californians to stay home. On that same day, we spoke with comedian Tom Papa about his Netflix special, You're Doing Great.
When I was little, I used to look at grown-ups with money and cars and think, wow, that looks fun. I can't wait. Then I was an adult for 6 weeks. I'm like, this blows. I have to pay for everything. Just the physical maintenance of you every day, right? It's endless. Just the brushing and cleaning and wiping, hopefully every day. It's like you're your own pet.
2 months later, the world has changed, and Tom Papa has a new book of essays titled You're Doing Great and Other Reasons to Stay Alive. Considering where we are in the pandemic, that seemed like a good message to me, so I called him up to talk. Tom, welcome back to the show.
Good to talk to you again.
Considering that you're out and about right now, I mean, how do you feel about being out and about in Los Angeles?
I've never been so happy to see traffic. I was driving on the 101. It was actually backed up. I was like, oh my God, this is feeling like normal. I can't believe this. It feels okay, but it feels weird. I just keep, you know, everywhere you go, the masks for me are the big thing that makes you feel like it's not normal. And, yeah. You know, there's all these little things. But I just feel like I just keep reminding myself it's for the greater good and it's not permanent. This isn't the way life is going to be for us forever. This is going to be a moment we're going to look back on it. But just keep in mind that we're doing good for people and that it's not going to be forever. And it calms me down for a minute. And then I yo-yo. Like this whole thing has been a yo-yo experience. I'm so happy to be out at the beach. Oh, but I can't bring my lawn chair. Okay, it's going to be just fine.
What kind of things, though, Tom, do you think will be forever once we get past this? And we keep hearing how life will never be the same. The new normal will not be the way it used to be. What kind of things do you think might not change?
I don't know. I don't know if much will be. If the virus runs its course and we're back, if virally we're back to where we were before, I don't see how much is going to be that different. I mean, I would hope that we take some thoughtful things out and we cook more and we are appreciative of things more. You know, when my grandparents went through the Great Depression, they looked at food a totally different way for the rest of their lives, and they were very frugal, and they made sure that they always had it. And maybe there'll be some lasting impressions of that. But as far as the culture, I don't know. People are still cutting me off on the freeway. I think people are still making out in public. I don't know. That stuff, I think, is all going to come roaring back.
Yeah, when people start flipping each other off, on the 101, then that's, it's all back to normal.
Yeah. I can't believe I'm driving around like a little old lady, just trying to be nice and not cause any more trouble. And people have all this space around me. They're riding my bumper and giving me the finger. I guess I'm still in LA.
Yeah. We're talking to comedian Tom Papa. His new book is titled "You're Doing Great" and Other Reasons to Stay Alive. Now, you mentioned your grandparents, and that's one of the things we talked about the last time we spoke, was how you're doing great. That title is not something you came up with out of thin air. It's informed by your grandparents who lived through a world war and a great depression. But you know what? I was watching Fight Club a few days ago. And Tyler Durden says, as in the Brad Pitt version, not the Ed Norton version, but he goes, "We have no great war, no great depression. Our great war is a spiritual war. Our great depression is our lives." So I'm wondering, Tom, has the pandemic crossed the line yet into being this generation's great event that will define and shape us?
It will for young people. I have a daughter that's graduating and going to college next year. It's going to mark her generation for that, for sure. The hard part is that there's no VE Day. We're not going to just October 15th, it's all over, and we come into the streets and cheer and we have that moment. It has this malaise and this lingering aspect to it that is going to kind of prevent it from being that big event, that had a beginning and an end, and we all had that moment. But we are not going to forget this for sure.
I'm assuming, Tom, at some point you're going to get back on a stage and do a stand-up routine. I would think that's something that's in your future. I don't know when, but eventually. What would it take for you to be comfortable to get back on stage facing a crowd that's going to be laughing droplets in your direction?
I'm okay to go now. I feel I'm all right to go now. If the club is conscientious, I'm not afraid to go do that. As long as they're thinking the right way and doing the right things, I'm ready to go. I have an offer to go in Utah in 2 weeks, and I'd have to fly there and I'd have to stay in a hotel, and I'd have to get up on stage, but. You know, I just keep saying, and it's so weird. It's you question leadership, but then you want to rely on it. But if the club is allowed to open by law, and the law has determined that it's okay, and the people feel good enough to come out, then I'm going to feel good enough to go and participate with them.
Wow, it sounds like you're leaning. You're like you're going to do it. If as you said, if all the things get cleared, you're going to go do it.
If I wasn't married, I would definitely be doing it.
Okay, now Tom Papa hedges his bets a little bit.
I haven't convinced all parties. Not all parties in my house are of the same thinking as I am.
Wow. Because that's what I was going to ask you about, getting on a plane, because there are some states, Montana, Wyoming, Utah is also one of them that isn't as loaded with infections as, say, California, New York. Yeah. And I was going to wonder, like, what would it take to get you to go to these kind of states?
I feel like it's safer to fly now than it was at the end. You know, I flew right up until the Tom Hanks day.
Oh,
and,
wow.
You know, that was, you know, I was in Washington State. I was in California. I was in New York for a week. I mean, you know, undetected and flying around, it was just like, I don't know. I feel like now with all the precautions, I feel like it's safer to do it now than it was then. So, you know, it's all about calculated risk and you know, we still wipe things down and then we do other things that seem stupid. And I feel like at this point, it's just playing the odds and trying to get the odds in your favor. But like I said, if people are saying, they're taking the precautions and they're ready to go, I'm ready to go.
One thing, though, I got to admit, I get a little bummed when I see and hear people act in a way that the science says is not smart. So, like, not wearing a mask, crowding close to other people. And that's where I think the second half of your book title, Other Reasons to Stay Alive, can apply. What would you say to people who maybe are doing things that doesn't seem like there are reasons to stay alive?
Yeah, I think you have to think of others. I think that is what should be driving everybody. And, you know, there are people in the culture that think about me, and there are people in the culture that think about we. And this is a moment where you have to think about we. And I know you get scared, and I know it's uncomfortable, and we all feel that, and we all feel frustrated. But if this is, I don't want to, and you know, you say, well, it's just old people. Yeah, well, I know a lot of old people. And I want to just do right by them, so I can be uncomfortable and feel weird in the grocery store with a mask on for a couple more months or whatever it takes. This is about we. And I wish people were beating that drum a little bit louder.
Tom, if you take that gig in Utah, can you come back on the show and tell us how it went? Because I'm just fascinated.
Oh.
I'm dying to know what that would have been like.
Absolutely. The first time I'm on stage, I will call you.
Perfect. Perfect. Tom Papa's new book is You're Doing Great and Other Reasons to Stay Alive. Tom, as always, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. As always, you can find us on Twitter. We're at Take Two. That's at Take Two. I'm there as well, at A Martinez LA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.